Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl from Deviant Legion, and this is the Incredibly Strange Film podcast. And we're doing our ninth podcast. We've been doing this since July, and very, very happy to be here. And all you that listen, you're making this a very, very successful podcast series, so we really appreciate it. Unfortunately, tonight, my co-host had a slight difficulty, and she will not be joining us, so Corey will be here next week. But I do want to introduce our guest. Our guest is film director Mark Savage. Mark has been doing this since the 1980s, first in his native Australia, and now here in the U.S., and he does a lot of really good direct-to-video independent features, and we're very happy to have you here, Mark.
Hey, it's really good to be here, Carl.
Well, good.
Great
so,
to be on your show.
So anyway, why don't you introduce yourself and like just tell us how you got started and all that sort of good stuff.
Sure. I got started initially making Super 8 movies. That was my, you know, gauge of choice when I was a, you know, when I was a kid. I financed, say, like my first 50 movies, which were all shorts, by working at McDonald's. By essentially, I worked at one of Melbourne's first McDonald's, you know, flipping burgers, you know, cooking fries. Worked like, you know, I think I did about 20 hours a week, and each of those went towards film stock. And with those, I made Super 8 movies on a little chin-on camera. I mostly cut those movies in camera, which was sort of was a really good to teach me a certain discipline, because, you know, when you've only got 3 minutes of film and you're kind of cutting in camera, and the reason I cut in camera was because when you did the splices were really noticeable and sometimes got jammed in the projector. But, yeah, I mean, they were the first films that I made. It pretty much came from my own love of making movies, and at about 15 or... I don't know, 14 or 15 or so, I just said to myself, well, this is what I want to do. I want to make movies. I mean, I was really influenced by watching films like, I guess, mostly horror, you know, films like Larry Buchanan's It's Alive was a big influence on me. Some of the, you know, also like It's the Terror from Beyond Space, the Harryhausen film Valley of the Guanji.
Oh, you absolutely.
Know, yeah, those are the films that, you know, those are the films that I was really drawn towards. And the first films that I made were mostly monster movies, you know, shot on Super 8, usually starring my brother. He was usually the protagonist, but I mean, sometimes if we're short of actors, he was the antagonist as well. So he'd literally be chasing himself and killing himself. And, you know, those are the first films that I made. And I guess that's where I really learned. That's where I really learned in terms of like, you know, shooting and exposing the images, you know, because there's nothing quite as unforgiving as a Super 8 camera, because you're shooting on reversal film, so, you know, you got to be pretty spot on with your exposures. And of course, if you're only shooting 3 minute movies, you know, you don't have a lot of room for fat, you don't have a lot of room to make mistakes, and especially if you're cutting in camera, every take has actually got to be right. So I think that really helped me a lot in terms of, you know, discipline, you know, framing, you know, not wasting time on unnecessary takes, you know, just sort of getting it right in rehearsal before shooting it, which was more a thing with film than it is now with digital. Digital tends to be often that, you know, you just let the camera keep rolling and, you know, you do take after take and you often don't even call cut as much. But back in those days, you know, film was very expensive. It was like $400 to shoot 10 minutes of film. About the same to, let's say, get it printed and processed. So it's $800 for 10 minutes. Then you sometimes either get it telecined, where you transfer it to like a editable medium, or you cut it like on a steam bed. And so you're spending about $1,000 for 10 minutes. So especially when you're you're not rich, you know, you're just a young filmmaker. Every kind of frame counts. So, yeah, I mean, that was really where That was really where I started. But I guess you'd say when I really got quite motivated is that I moved to the States when I was 18, and I lived in Detroit. And my exposure in Detroit to filmmaking was kind of interesting because this was in like 81, aside from the fact that I was, you know, being exposed to all these great movies in Detroit and theaters that were showing all these films that were banned in Australia, you know, like Texas Chainsaw and Last House on the Left and all that kind of stuff. I remember there was a news story. There was a program called PM Magazine, and they had a story about these guys who were making a film, some local guys in Detroit, and they were called Renaissance Pictures. And they'd made a film called, you know, at the time, it was called Book of the Dead. I remember hearing about that and seeing it, and I go, oh, I'm going to call those guys up. Well, not even really knowing, you know, eventually who they would become. And I called up Renaissance Pictures, which were in a place called, I think it was called Ferndale in Detroit, in Michigan.
Okay.
And Bruce Campbell answered the phone, and he kind of answered it like he was in one of his movies, because I just remember him picking up the phone and he sort of went, hello, you know, in that kind of Bruce Campbell style. You know, and I sort of gave him some spiel about, you know, I'm this Australian filmmaker. I mean, I just made Super 8 at the time and heard about their film. I'd love to come down and get some advice. And he said, yeah, come on down. And I went on down there, and sitting in the office was Rob Tappert, Sam Raimi, Scott Spiegel, and Josh Becker. We're all just kind of like sitting in the office because they were about to go and do a sound mix on a film called Waiters of the Lost Park, which is also called The Adventures of Cleveland Smith. Anyway, I drove down with Bruce Campbell. He had this big car. I can't remember what type of car it was, but it was one of those kind of big ones you often see, you know, the mafia driving, and drove down to a sound mix and then sort of like, you know, hung out with those guys for a couple of days, you know, and it was really inspiring, you know, because they'd gone ahead and, you know, made this movie. And at that time, this is before Stephen King saw the film in Cannes and gave it an amazing review. So, you know, all they were talking about was, you know, they hope to have a, you know, a Detroit screening soon, and they got the film with a sales agent, you know, but at that time it hadn't really taken off. But, I mean, that was very inspiring for, you know, the young me. I think I was about 19 or 17. I can't exactly remember how old I was back then, but that was quite inspirational. So then I stayed in Detroit and worked for Orion Pictures for a couple of years, and then eventually did some work for Fox as well and Orion. But this is because those studios had branch offices in those cities, and in Detroit there was an MGM and a Fox and a Orion, and I worked on a few publicity campaigns for Orion, like Lone Wolf McQuade and Strange Invaders and Easy Money and Class with Andrew McCarthy. And so then I went back to Australia eventually, and I started making my own movies, and I did my first movie, my first feature there, because I worked at a video company that also did dubbing, and I was their porno dubber from 11 a.m.
to
8 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, and because I was the only person, I think I was the only person they could find who was happy to work late hours like that. It went late hours. It was like the night shift, and it was my way to get. I wanted to get into production there, even though I already made my own films by then. I mean, but they were just short films. But some of my shorts were features, but they were features on Super 8. I hadn't actually done any. I did about 3 or 4 of those. And I was a night dubber because during the day they did production, and they also had some Christian clients. So they didn't want the Christian clients knowing that they were also doing porno dubbing at night. And that was the reason that they had a guy doing the porno dubbing. So that was me. And I didn't just do porno dubbing. I also dubbed a lot of exploitation films as well, because there was a label called KTEL Video in Australia. And KTEL, like, specialised in, exploitation stuff, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Hard Rock Zombies, a number of, you know, films fairly obscure, and even a lot more obscure exploitation films. But anyway, I worked there long enough dubbing porno movies until eventually porno movies got banned in Australia, so then they stopped dubbing them. And I convinced the guy who owned the company, I told him, this is once I was now in production, I was now shooting and directing commercials and that, and I said to him one day, you know something, you've got all this equipment sitting around doing nothing. it's a shame, you know, that it's just being wasted on the weekend. You know, that's a lot of money just going down the drains. And he said, you know, what's your point? And I said, well, my point is, why don't you let us make a movie? You know, like, why don't you let us, you know, go out, use the equipment, make a feature film. If it makes any money, you know, I'll give you half the money. And so he sort of went, okay, as long as it doesn't interfere with what you're doing during the week for us. I said, no. And that was how I made my first production, which was a film called Marauders.
That just came on DVD in the aughts. So we didn't see it here in the U.S. until a number of years later.
What is that,
1986, I think?
Yeah, that's right. It was shot around 85, 86, came out in late 86, 87. Very, very small release in Australia. Not, you know, because it was actually, even in Australia at that time, the tide had kind of turned a little bit on exploitation stuff, so there wasn't quite as much. I mean, also because mine was like, there was also that one was actually shot on video, even though later on I did features on film. But the reason it was shot on video, because that was what I got access to, and it was like the first film that got shot on video in Australia, and probably one of the early films in the world that was shot on video. It was shot on 1-inch videotape. And then a guy who was a client of mine, who I used to shoot commercials for, a guy called Ollie Martin, he also then made his own video feature, which was influenced by watching my feature, and me telling him about it. It was a film called Houseboat Horror. That was another, like, shot-on-video feature that was done in Melbourne. But, you know...
So let me ask you a question. Okay, well, no. Finish up, and then I've got a question.
Yeah, actually, I'd rather you just give me questions. It's probably better because I feel like
here you are in Australia, and of course these days the idea of exploitation, and the Brian Trenchard Smith films, you know, Dead End Drive-In and so on and so forth, and all those wonderful, wonderful films out in the 70s and 80s. How much of those films had an influence on your early work, if any?
I would say probably not a lot, because Trenchard Smith's films, the more high-profile ones, were released in the 70s. You know, films like, you know, The Man from Hong Kong and Death Cheaters, and even one of the films that I dubbed, which was BMX Bandits, which was like a later day Trenchard Smith. And Turkey Shoot was a 70s film. I mean, I like those movies, but in a way, I was more influenced definitely by American movies. And the interesting thing was, back in those days, censorship was really, really strict in Australia. So, for example, films like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Last House on the Left, and even a lot of the Italian horror films that we love today, they were really heavily cut in Australia or banned. And Texas Chainsaw was banned. So the first film that I made, which was Marauders, that was more influenced to a large extent by the banning of American films I wanted to see that I didn't see, or at least films I saw later on in my life, because I never saw Texas in the 70s. I saw Texas as I just mentioned, when I moved to the US for a few years, I went to the first screening of Texas in about 82. It was playing at a mall, like a re-release. And that was a huge influence. Another film that was a big influence on Marauders was the William Frewitt film, House by the Lake. Weekend. Yeah, that was a huge influence. And if you look at Marauders and see what the story is of Marauders, it kind of follows, to some extent, the plot line of House by the Lake, at least to the extent that it's kind of like about a sleazy guy driving up to a country house with a woman he wants to, you know, do obscene, he's got obscene ambitions for her, and it's about how his plan goes wrong because he stumbles across other people along the way who are even worse than him, or who use his actions as an excuse to be violent towards him. So I'd say those were a lot more influence on me. I'd say more like European and American films rather than Australian films. if there's any Australian filmmaker who was an influence on me, it was actually Richard Franklin. And it was because Richard Franklin and I became friends, but we became friends after Marauders, and it was only because, to be quite honest, in Australia it was kind of interesting. Even though Trenchard was making his films, and I think he was mostly Sydney-based, a lot of the people that I was going to try to get money before I made Marauders, you were kind of treated like a bit of a pariah in Australia wanting to make this kind of movie. So, and it's weird because you wouldn't know that watching the watching Mark Hartley's documentary. You would think, oh, well, the Australian government and everyone must have really embraced that genre. But really, they didn't. And even when Mad Max came out, you know, you would have thought there would be like a glut of Mad Max imitators and other people kind of jumping on that bandwagon. But that never really happened in Australia. It did happen in other countries, especially like Italy and to some extent in America. But the Australian industry has always been a little odd because even though there are some exploitation genre films made now, because a lot of Australian films are government financed, there's always been this kind of weird sort of pretentiousness about, well, people want to be associated with the kind of films that, you know, that you're going to win awards with, you know, like at Cannes. And, you know, it's almost like being culturally accepted is actually more important than making films, for example, that are popular or making money. So in Australia, there's always been a little bit of a thing of, well, if you make a film that's too popular, it's like a bad thing. You know, you're going to make a film that gets awards and that type of thing. And I was really feeling that around that time. And so that was why, again, so when I met Richard Franklin, when I finished Marauders, I'd met a guy who was his friend, who was a lawyer, and he just said to me, oh, I should show your new film, because I was looking for a distributor. I should show it to my friend who I represent, Richard Franklin. I went, oh, really? You represent Richard Franklin? And he said, yeah. He goes, I might show it to Richard. Richard might enjoy your movie. Anyway, he showed it to Richard, and for the first time ever, I had someone who was an adult, you know, who was a real filmmaker in Australia, who didn't just look at my stuff and kind of go, oh, all that exploitation rubbish, because that's what I'd gotten beforehand with even my Super 8. A lot of the filmmakers there would sort of like almost look down on you because you're making genre films. But Richard was really complimentary. You know, I mean, he didn't say it was a masterpiece, but he said it's really well shot. You know, you definitely know what you're doing. And, you know, he said, you know, the subject matter was a little bit too extreme for him. But he said, I like the movie. I think you have talent. I mean, that was great for me to hear because, of course, back in those days, you know, it's nice just to hear that coming from an established filmmaker. And that had a really big influence on me, and I was eternally grateful to him for that. And he and I became friends, you know, and we kind of hang out for a bit. And, you know, I followed him through a few productions as well, kind of shadowing him. He did commercials and also a number of more films in Australia, although he never really did once I met him. He wasn't then really doing the exploitation stuff. He did a film called Hotel Sorrento and, you know, commercials. But at the same time, he was a great guy, very humble. Humble sort of guy, very, you know, very encouraging. And, you know, he had a real influence on me, you know, just feeling like, you know, that just because I'm making films in the genre, it doesn't mean I'm less of a filmmaker, you know, than someone making films about something that you might deem sort of like, you know, so-called, you know, important issues or issue-related movies. I mean, it was just nice having someone saying, you know, well, what you're doing is, it's legitimate filmmaking just as much as someone else, you know, doing something different that's also legitimate filmmaking.
Well, you know, a lot of that is sort of what we do at ISF because, you know, you go and you see films and you know, you get all the superhero movies and so on and so forth, and we want something different. And, of course, a lot of people, you know, go to horror. I go for more experimental stuff. But, it you know, the thing is, if a film is done well, and it's well shot and it's well done, there it's going to find an audience sooner or later. There's no question.
Yeah, I agree. Because to me, yeah, it's there's an interesting Roger Ebert quote where he said, when you're reviewing a film, it's not what it's about, it's how it's about. And I like that because he's essentially saying that any subject matter can be interesting depending on your approach. I mean, I also, myself, from a very early age, was very interested in, even though my original influences were the usual stuff like, you know, dinosaur movies and things like that, I mean, one of my favorite films of all time is The Tin Drum, the German film.
Yeah.
And, you know, you watch a film like that, and, you know, seeing it at a very young age, or about, I think about 17 or so, you know, I watched that film and I'm sort of thinking, yeah, you can go anywhere with filmmaking, you know. And I think it's also that indie film is the expression of the outsider. I've always felt like an outsider. I've never felt like I'm, you know, I'm not, certainly not part of any club or gang or, you know, or broader culture of artists or whatever. You know, I've always felt like an outsider because I've done a lot of my own stuff on films. Like, I've often produced it. I've usually nearly always produced it as well as directed it. Until, you know, recently, I never really had anyone who I'd say, well, this is my dedicated producer, and we work together on films. I mean, now it's starting to emerge. I'm starting to work with a few other people who are taking producer roles. But, you know, I was always felt like I was on my own. So even when I was putting films together, ultimately it was still up to me to, like, raise the money and do that. And that's why I felt like an outsider. But I really do think that indie films, you know, are a great voice for the outsider mentality. You know, and I think in a way that's what keeps you... That kind of keeps you alive. And I think in some extent that, you know, I'm not really quite sure where I'd be if I hadn't had the, you know, been able to sort of create create somewhere where I can express myself like film. I don't know where I'd be if I didn't do that. You know, like, I'd either be very depressed or maybe dead, or I don't know. But I think it's a great release to make films, to be able to put your, you know, ideas onto the screen. And it's hard to do because, you know, there's all this business involved with it. But I think the outside aspect of it is a lot more prevalent as an indie filmmaker than, say, studio film. Because with a studio film, you know, even though probably a lot of people who were originally indie films are also making studio films, but at the same time, when you're making indie films all the time, yeah, you're always expressing that side of being kind of outside the mainstream, kind of pushing against the grain.
Right, exactly. And we had a guest on about a month ago. I don't know if you know him. His name is Mark Pirro. And
yes,
what he said
I do,
is...
I do know Mark, yes.
Yeah, but Mark said there are two things. You do it no matter what. You know, the money doesn't matter. If you have 100, 200, you do it, but you do it for yourself first.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. You know, and that's the... Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I want to get moving here a little bit. And one thing I've got to say about going through your filmography is you've got some of the best titles ever. Seriously. I mean, Sensitive New Age Killer. Right there, you got me. I don't know what it's about, but I'm watching it. Or, you know. Mask Avenger versus Ultravillain in the Lair of the Naked Bikini. That,
well,
I've got to see. You've got to tell me where the hell to find that.
Well, actually, it's interesting. I got approached by a well-known distributor quite recently about doing a special edition of that film of Naked Bikini. But the original title of that, and you'll find this interesting, the distributor came to me and said, look, we don't like, you know, we're thinking of changing the original title and going with something a little bit more mainstream. So their idea of something more mainstream was Master Avenger versus Ultravillain in the Lair of the Naked Bikini. But the original title was The Masturbating Gunman. So of course, the Naked Bikini part just doesn't really make any sense. I mean, there is a Master Avenger. I mean, the main guy... It's sort of like a black comedy. It was financed out of Japan, but it's a black comedy about a guy who tracks down kidnapped women by smelling their panties, and he follows the scent to where they are. But what happens is that when he gets close to the kidnappers, the villains send out women to strip in front of him, which of course then renders him into a masturbating mess. He then falls over and hopefully, you know, and they then attempt to kill him before he can rescue the women.
I remember telling me this on the previous podcast. I've got to see this movie. I have to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of unavailable everywhere now. I mean, it came out of VHS, but yeah, I have had a lot of interest in the last, like, year or so. So I am putting together a new version of that, which will probably be under the original title because of just that... the naked bikini part doesn't really make any sense at all, even though there are women in bikinis in the movie. It's sort of like a comic book, sort of black comedy, comic bookish kind of film. And Sense of New Age Killer, was that. That's also a retitling of but that was put out by Fox in Australia. That was released by 20th Century Fox, and that was really them not liking the original title so much, and then this new title was proposed to them. So when it came out theatrically in Australia, that was a title that they went with. And it sort of was about a guy kind of like struggling with, you know, being a killer, but sort of having a slightly kind of new age kind of sensibility about him, which of course throughout the movie you realize that that's all bullshit and he doesn't really have that at all. He's just really like a killer who basically should just shut up and he should just shut up and kill and stop worrying about being new age about it.
Mm-hmm.
So as we go through your filmography, what films would you recommend people to find out, and where can we see some of these films?
I guess the film, in a sense, I feel that maybe closest to, I mean, that's sort of closest maybe to me, and the one I'm happiest with that's released, in the sense of happy with the way it came out, would probably be the film that I put out a couple of years ago called Purgatory Road.
I remember when we did the previous podcast, it had just come out, and I got to see it. It is a tremendous film, Mark, and definitely want to get our members to watch it. So yeah, let's talk about Purgatory Road.
Yeah, Purgatory Road. I mean, you can watch it at the moment. It's on Amazon. It's on Amazon Prime. It's also on Tubi TV. It's also on iTunes. There's also a Blu-ray release of it through Unearthed Films as well, and a DVD release. And it's pretty much coming out throughout the world at the moment. It recently got picked up by a British sales company called Jinga Films. So Jinga at the moment just put it out also in Australia. So it's just hit the Australian, I think, Fetch TV in Australia. Again, iTunes, Google Play, also New Zealand as well. It's just come out there as well. It's heading for a release also in the UK. It'll be out in the UK in about 2 months. So, yeah, I mean, I feel it's kind of like one of the films that's closest to my own real sensibility, and maybe the film that I feel that I kind of achieved closest to what I set out to achieve. If you sort of say, well, 100% is what you want to get. I would say it probably came close to, and I mean, I'm not sort of trying to say this in a conceited way, like I'm any kind of genius, but I would just say maybe kind of comes about 85%, 90% of what I originally envisioned. And so, yeah, I'm very proud of that one. Great score, too, by Glenn Gabriel. It stars Trista Robinson, who's just amazing as you know, complete psycho chick. Gary Cans and Luke Albright, like they're the main actors in the movie. You know, it was shot in Mississippi, and it's about a priest who's completely off his nut, and he takes confessionals in a confession van. They drive a confession van across the countryside, the highways in Mississippi, and his problem is that when someone confesses to stealing, he can't forgive them because he's got something that happened back in his own past where a thief destroyed his family. So the film sort of hinges on him, you know, him not being able to control himself, and as a result, he starts, he completely comes apart at the seams, and when your psycho chick enters the scene, played by Trista Robinson, you know, that's kind of like, almost like the end of his relationship with his brother, who's been really loyal to him all his life, and, you know, they're forced to come to a reckoning that ends in a very bloody way, but, you know, I think one of the best, quotes that someone did on the movie, it was actually the horror writer, Ray Garten. You know, he watched the movie and he said, it's like Flannery O'Connor on meth. So I figured, hey, I like that one. You know, I'm a big fan of Flannery O'Connor. So if you can kind of see that kind of, you know, Flannery O'Connor kind of gothic sort of aspect to it.
When you say Flannery O'Connor, I immediately go to Wise Blood. And when I first saw the film a year and a half, 2 years ago, when you got me a screener, that's exactly where I went. It was like Wise Blood on acid is what I thought. It's really good in terms of the religious aspect too of it, which I find interesting that there seems to be more and more exploitation films that are using that aspect in part of their films. I've really found the film really, really good. I was really impressed with it, Mark.
Oh, well, thank you. I really, really appreciate that. You know, because obviously when you make the film, you know, you're hoping it's going to resonate with people. I mean, the personal aspect for me was that I was raised a Catholic, and I went to a pretty strict Catholic school, and I saw a lot of hypocrisy at the school, which was mostly, you know, priests beating up students, that kind of stuff, which was very accepted at that school. Like the priest would literally smash someone on the head with a chair or punch a kid in the hallway, and that was just like accepted. I remember going home to my parents and saying, you know, Father so-and-so went and punched this kid today, and my parents' reaction would be, well, what did he do? it was kind of accepted, and then I saw it. So yeah, I mean, I wasn't really, you know, I wasn't much of a religious convert, but at the same time with the movie, it's also about, I mean, there is a good priest in the movie as well, so I didn't want to make a film that was just completely just one-dimensional, just saying that all priests are bad. I mean, because they're not all bad, and it's not as interesting when you just make a film where there's no opposition or there's no other side to it. But, yeah, I'd say for me, yeah, I mean, that's a film maybe people can start with. Then I'd say maybe the next one would be the film Stress to Kill with Amanda Sante and Bill Oberst. And it's probably a film everyone can relate to because it's about a guy played by Oberst who's just bloody sick of the world, people being rude, people using cell phones in movies and shit like that. So he basically decides, you know, he's going to fix his problem up, and that's by killing people, because a doctor tells him he has a heart attack in the earlier scene, and the doctor says, dude, you've got to start identifying and eliminating the problems in your life, otherwise you're going to have another heart attack and die. So he just starts identifying, you know, where he's stress is coming from, which is obviously from other people, and he starts killing them. So it's and then Amanda Sante plays this cop, but even though he's a cop and he's following him and trying to work out who's doing this, there's a certain part of him that admires what Bill's doing, and that's kind of like where the movie goes. And you know, I think Asante is really good in the movie. Bill Oberst, as always, is really great in the movie. I mean, I've done a few films with Bill. I just finished one with Bill, which was Painkiller. And in a sense, Painkiller is like an extension of his character in Stress to Kill. It's the same character, but it's not a literal sequel to that film. But there's a couple of the same characters from Stress to Kill that are in Painkiller. Painkiller's not released yet. I mean, it's finished, but it'll be out in about sort of three to six months. But yeah, I reckon people start with Purgatory Road, Stress to Kill, and as I said, Masturbating Gunman is coming out, and the other one is Sensitive New Age Killer, which will also be getting re-released soon as Hitman's Hero. So I'd say maybe start with that. I mean, I did a couple of softcore kind of crime thrillers too, Trail of Passion, also Fishnet, also Sentimental Assassin. I mean, there are a couple of films are really hard to find, hard to get now, but, you know, and Pond Scum's not finished yet. Like, rather, I've got a little bit more to go on it, but I'm sort of holding off on releasing Pond Scum. I mean, that's been in the works for a long time, but that's had all kinds of issues kind of related to, you know, just related to not really technical issues, but just related to cast and, you know, various aspects that has kind of stopped me from finishing the entire movie. But, yeah, I'd say, yeah, Purgatory Road, Stress to Kill, and then Painkiller when it comes out might be a good start for my movies.
Okay, so just tell me, you know, as you go on with you know, you start out with Marauders and doing films, how do you sustain yourself in terms of going from one project to the next? Was it a very simple, like you get hired or what is the process once you have an idea and how long does it take and what does it take to do to get a film done?
Yeah, I would say it's pretty much like from Marauders, you know, I think each project, I've had a couple of people over the years like wanting to hire me to do a movie, but I think there's only ever done one that I wanted to do, but because I didn't like the script. I mean, it's not that I won't do films that other people have, but it's really very much got to do with the script. So I tend to make films, you know, just like what Mark Pirro said. I mean, I make the films I'd want to see. That's the bottom line. You know, I kind of get an idea. And as a big fan of movies myself, I mean, I see a lot of movies as well. I mean, I probably see about, you know, every year I average probably about 300 to about 500 films a year I see. I try to watch at least one a day, either at 5 in the morning or 11 at night, whatever. But so I'm a big fan. So the thing is, I was a fan first. So I kind of make the kind of movie I'd want to see. So the thing is, in sustaining myself, it's really just every project, you're almost starting from scratch in a sense, because unless you've made a film that made $100 million profit, it's very, you know, very few people are going to, you know, ask you to make a movie and throw money at you, because it's very much based on the amount of money your films are made. And my films usually make their money back, but, you know, they're not making 20 times the budget. You know, they're making like, you know, 1.5 or twice, sometimes 3 times the budget. But, you know, so that doesn't get press, you know, because people want to hire someone whose film costs $10 million and it's made $500 million. So yeah, I go to investors. I often put my own money into movies as well. But yeah, I find investors who are like-minded in terms of the subject matter they're interested in. So if I know I'm going to be meeting with someone, I find out what kind of movies do they like. You know, what's their personal interest for wanting to invest in a movie? Because at this level where you're asking people for more, like say, you know, $500,000 or, you know, a couple of million rather than $100 million. You're not going to people who are running hedge funds. You know, you're going to people who do have money, who have a certain, a certain high net worth. But you're trying to connect with them on why do you want to invest in the movie. That's a personal thing. And sometimes it's that they'll say, well, they always wanted to make a movie. Maybe when they were younger, they wrote a script and it was one of their ambitions to make a film sometime, one of their ambitions to do something creative. And they're often the people who invest in a movie. Aside from that, you can also get people who say, hey, you know, my son or my daughter are interested in making movies. Would you be interested in having them on the set? They'd like to learn a bit from following you or whatever. So that's another reason. But yeah, I mean, I find that I build relationships with investors and it takes sometimes, you know, a long time. And often they become lifelong friends. And not every investor even keeps investing film after film because they also have changes in their financial situation. So I might have an investor who invests in every second film that I do. And that's all fine, you know, because everyone has their own individual reasons for investing or not investing. But between films, I sustain myself. I also have a sense like a second career where I also shoot for, I do a lot of natural history stuff for like NHK Japan, like shooting, you know, nature documentaries and that kind of stuff. I do a bit of shooting for the BBC. I also do shooting for Screen Factory, Shout Factory, Vinegar Syndrome, and those. I also shoot interviews as well for those companies. So I've always had like a second career as a cinematographer. I shoot documentaries. I just made a film called Fusion as well, which I shot and directed with a producer named Tim Chisma. So on those, I tend to, those tend to sustain me in between the movies. And then I have a production company with my, I have another producer partner named Tom Parnell, and he also invests in some of the films, and sometimes he'll, you know, co-write the films with me as well, you know. So again, I always align with people who are like-minded. So for example, I'm also at the moment on the brink of doing a sports film for children. It's like a girls soccer film. So of course, the investors for that are different than the investors who want to invest in something like Painkiller or Pond Scum. So again, you're going for people who've got certain taste, and that's always kind of what's worked for me, you know, that you research the investors and then you kind of make them partners in the movie. You're like, I don't make the kind of films where someone just goes, you know, where I just say, just give me a check and I'll see you in 6 months. It's never like that for me. For me, it's always like I get to know the people. They come down to the set, they watch the movie, you know, and we become friends. I mean, I sort of rather be like that. They also then see that the process is transparent. You know, like that's the important thing, that when you're getting people to invest money, you've got to be transparent about it. You know, so they understand that it's not that easy to make the money back, and it can take time. You know, I'm never going to tell an investor that, oh, yeah, invest in my movie in 6 months, you'll have three times the money you put in. That's never going to happen. And it's not that that doesn't occasionally happen, but that's like a lottery win. That's like guaranteeing them that they're going to win the lottery next Saturday. So,
right.
You know, I do the shooting. I'm doing a smaller film at the moment, too. That's a complete off-the-radar film. I can't even really talk about that, but that's like a little vampire film that I'm doing, too. I've just started shooting that one. And, you know, doing the distribution on Painkiller and developing a couple, three or four other projects as well. One's an action film, or another one's a second vampire film as well. And, I mean, cause I'm interested essentially in crime films, in horror, in action. And I also like films aimed at children as well, not necessarily Disney type of stuff, but more films like, say, Fly Away Home. I think that's one of my favorite films. Films that may be about younger characters, but, you know, because they're more about growing up and, you know, because everyone, I think everyone can relate to that, even when you're an adult, you know, the whole rite of passage kind of film for, you know, about growing up. That's still interesting to me, like a film like Stand By Me. Like, that's a just such a fascinating kind of subject. So, to me, it's all about, you know, it's all about human behavior. That's what films are about. It's about the inconsistency of human behavior. That's what sort of keeps me energized. And I'd never do anything else. I mean, I'll die making movies, and I don't care. That's what I'll die doing. So if I end up basically making $1,000 films at the end of my career, fine. I'm not doing anything else. This is what I do. You know, so I live and breathe this. And I still manage to have a semblance of a life, you know, in between the films as well. You know, you still have friendships. You still have relationships now and then and things like that. But ultimately, I love making movies, and that's why it doesn't matter whether I've got 100 grand or whether I've got $2-3 million, I'll find a way to make a movie. And I think one thing I think I can do pretty well, I'm pretty good at being able to say, okay, I know how to make 100,000 look like $500,000. At the same time, I can make 2 million look more like 10 million. You know what I mean? That's just from experience, you know. But, you know, you have good collaborators. That's another thing that's really important, that you have great collaborators. Like I work with great cinematographers who are friends. Line producers, you've got to find a great line producer who you're friends with, who's a good friend. Because it's like a marriage. I mean, you're like married to these people when you're making.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I've noticed with all the guests we have. It's all about family, and not only that, it's about passion.
Yes.
Because you get a family together, and who can do different things in search of a project. And then it's the passion, it's the wanting to get through. We do the same thing here with the podcast, because we have numerous people working in that. And so yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying. And you know, the thing is, go ahead.
No, sorry, I interrupted you.
Go ahead, Mark.
It's a shared experience. Like, it's like, for example, I mean, I also like climbing. So I do a bit of climbing now and then. I mean, I don't climb Everest, but I do a bit of climbing. But climbing with friends is a huge difference than climbing on your own. It's a shared experience. And in a way, that's what the creative experience of making a film is. It's a collaboration between you and a whole bunch of other people. And there's nothing quite like the magic if you've selected the people well. And after a while, you do cull out the bad apples, and you primarily have people you trust. You know, it's an amazing experience just going through that. Every day you start with a camera, a script, and by the end of the day you've got something that's on either film or it's on digital capture that you've basically transformed, you know, during the day. I mean, it's just an incredible experience. And to me, despite the fact that I don't really like the business side at all, I mean, I don't enjoy the business part of it, but it's absolutely necessary. But you've got to try to keep a separated your disenchantment with the business side with your love of the creation. To me, that's the one thing I learned, because I went through a period where I was hating it all because the business was getting me down so much, the finance raising and getting ripped off of distribution and everything. And for a while I did go through a period where I was just so pissed off at everything that I wasn't enjoying it. Then I just worked out a way that you've got to separate it, and that's what it is. I don't enjoy the business side. I mean, I try to, but I don't enjoy it. But I love the creative part of it, and that's a separate thing. And that part has never, ever kind of like, that's what sustains you. You look at a Japanese filmmaker, like one of my favorites, like Kenito Shindo, who did Onibaba, you know, he did a lot of movies. He was making movies until he was 99 years old. So to me, he's like my inspiration. Like, yeah, if I live even close to that, You know, I just keep making movies. I mean, there's just nothing, there really is just nothing like it. You know, so it's an addiction. It is like a drug addiction, because the high is like nothing else, and there is a downer as well. You do come down from it, but you've just got to, that's why you have friends. That's why you have, you know, people that you trust, because they help get you through that. And you should try to have a few other things in your life as well, so that you're not totally just reliant on that for all your thrills. Because if you're just totally reliant on one thing for everything, then that's when you can end up in a depressive state.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, so I just am in awe of, you know, the amount of work and the amount of passion that you and so many other people have for film. And certainly, I think we all do. The fans also have that passion. And that's where, you know, the filmmakers need to connect to the audience, and the audience needs to connect to the filmmakers. Because every film is unique. And each filmmaker has a specific point of view of passion that comes through. Excuse me. Sinuses, it happens. But for you, you know, and your films, and just hearing you talk, it's just like there's so much joy that comes through and so much love of what you do. And that really does come through, Mark. And I wanted to definitely say that to you.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it's never really gone away. As I said, I became disenchanted with the business side at some point. But every time I make a movie now, because people often say to me, like, oh, God, you know, are you doing another lower budget film? Didn't you say you're not doing any more of those? But I know I never really said that. The whole point is, the main thing to me is quality. And if you can still get quality, because there's definitely some ideas I just wouldn't do. Like, for example, there's certain ideas I would go, I can't do that for 50 grand, you know, but I can do this. Or, you know, this would need to be a bigger budget. Because the thing is, I'm still, like, fine. I'm very focused on the aesthetics of it. And also having a cinematography kind of, like, side to me as well. Like, I'm very much part of the shooting of the movie. You know, some directors are more like they kind of let the DP, you know, do a lot of the, choose more of the angles and the camera moves and stuff. I'm not really like that. So I work with cinematographers who were very close. I mean, I'll just go, okay, like, let's maybe shoot it through there, maybe put this lens on and all that. But then the cinematographer will go, well, how about we also do this? It's a very collaborative thing. So I'm kind of like more like wearing the cinematographer hat to some extent, but at the same time, you've hired someone who's really good at what they're doing. But at the same time, I'm still going to fix shots like, oh, yeah, can you pan that a little more to the left? Oh, that's not quite right. And sometimes I'll operate as well. So the thing is, but that's the whole point. It's who you choose to work with. You choose people who kind of like, and to me, that's the greatest kind of high of making the movie, is that once you've chosen the right people, and it's very important to do that, because a film can also be derailed by a few bad apples, you know, which does happen.
Oh, really?
Which does happen. You know, that you can make a film and you can have like two or three people who are either not down with what you're doing or basically are making negative comments and that. I mean, that can actually really hurt the whole morale of the movie, because it's certainly the job of the producer and the director to, you know, to also, you know, to push everyone forward, to give them a very clear concept of what you're doing and to respect that, but to also, you know, express kind of like an optimism. And the thing is, I would never make a film anyway that I wasn't passionate about. Like, I've never made a film where someone just said, well, I've got some money, do you want some money, here's a script, and I thought, oh, well, I'll do it for the money. I've never done that, and that's because to some extent that's why I kind of maintain my other career as a cinematographer, because that means I'm never pushed into that position where, oh yeah, do you want to do sequel number 19 to some pile of crap, and you know, you'll get like, you know, 20, 30 grand doing it. Like, to me, I've never done that, because I figured if I'm going to be pushing people, if I'm going to be expecting people to go to the mat on a project, then I've got to believe in it just as much, because otherwise I'm going to feel like a phony if I'm pushing people on a project that I think is a pile of crap. So that's why I just have no interest in that. So that's why, I guess that's why I've never done that much stuff when someone's come to me and said, oh, well, and it's happened. I got it offered, like, I won't say who it was about, but there was an action star. I mean, no longer a top-tier star, but there was an action star that I got offered not too long ago, and the script was just so terrible, so full of cliches. I just said, no, I don't want to do it. And they're like, come on, you know, this guy's, like, quite high profile. And I'm going, yeah, and that's just going to be another pile of crap film in his filmography, and my name's going to be attached to it. You know, the thing is, I'd rather just do something that you know, with the subject matter and with a script that you really believe in. I mean, Scorsese says the same stuff, and so I love him. You know, he says the same stuff. But like, why would I spend all that time doing something I didn't care about? I mean, that's how I feel, because I have to love what I'm doing, and also the thing is, when you want to bring people along with you, you've got to infect them with a positive contagion, and that's making that movie. And I can't infect them with a positive contagion if I don't believe that what we're doing has any worth, you know. And I'm not good at faking that. It's the same thing when people sometimes ask me, you know, what did you think of that film, you know, that I made? Because I get people coming to me occasionally or send me a movie and go, what do you think? And I said, do you really want to know what I think, or are you just want me to tell you it's great? And I'll tell people, a lot of times the usual criticism is, stop casting your friends, or why haven't you got a good sound recorder, or who the hell shot that movie, because basically it could be so much better. Because I really don't believe you've got to have a huge budget to make a good-looking movie and a film with good actors. There's lots of good actors around. So when someone says, well, we didn't really have a big budget, so we cast this, to me, my attitude today is, no, that's no excuse. There are so many good actors who are not getting cast at all, and a lot of talented people, even in the theatre, especially the theatre, go to the theatre. Cast people from that. There's no excuse to say, oh, well, yeah, we use my brother's sister in this role, and we use this guy who's a friend because we couldn't afford it. Well, if you just cannot even afford actors at all, then raise a bit more money to at least pay them something, because they deserve it. You know, don't screw people over, and especially don't screw people over while also making a movie with bad actors. That's like the worst thing you could do.
Yeah, and that's really good advice to a number of people on ISF. As I said, we're starting a new series of first filmmakers,
right.
And we've got one that's coming up on Friday. So I'll make sure that he listens to this because, you know, you want to be, you know, anyone who does a film, I got to give them credit for doing it, but you want to do it right.
Yeah.
And if you don't do it right, the next time you want to do it better. And you always, you got to strive for that.
I totally agree. And because what people sometimes don't realize, and I learned it the hard way, because I cast a couple of shitty actors in my film Marauders. And the hard lesson for me is that a couple of people who watched it, all they talked about was the two bad actors, and they didn't even have large roles in the movie. Their first comment was, oh, hell, where the hell did you get her from? You know, and that's my fault. It's not really her fault. It's my fault because I cast her. And the reason I cast her back in that time, because one actress dropped out. We were desperate. Oh, shit, we've got the shoot tomorrow, so let's see if we can find someone. We found someone at short notice. What we should have done is said, let's not shoot tomorrow. Let's spend the next week looking for a better actor. So, yeah, and the other thing is too, and this is things that directors need to realize, is that when you've got good actors, they make you look better as a director.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, how many times have I heard the saying that a good film is 90% casting?
Yeah, so
seriously.
True. Yeah, so true. Well, even look at, like, for example, like actors who you know, throughout their career have pretty much said yes to everything, or at least at a certain time. Like, say, like an actor named like Michael Caine. There was a time when he was saying yes to everything. But even in crappy movies, shitty movies, even like, say, like a movie like Water, Caine is still good to watch in that movie. It's not a good movie, but Caine is still fun to watch because he's good in it. So if you go, you've also got a good script, yeah, like, you know, having a great actor, because they're your storyteller. They're the person that the audience is connecting with. And they're not literally narrating the movie. I mean, sometimes they are, but the audience is expressing their emotions, the emotions you want them to feel through the actor. So why would you not make it your number one priority to very carefully cast that person? Because if it's the wrong person, then the audience is not going to catch the emotions that you want them to feel. And to me, that's, and every role should be cast like it's a lead role. I mean, on the film I just did, I was telling that to someone I was, who was doing some casting, to Eve. I said, let's cast every single role, like even the ones that have got one line, but cast them like if the person doing one line was the lead in the movie, would you cast them? Don't take this attitude about, hey, they've only got one line, so, you know, we'll just do with it. No, that's not the way to go. Always cast someone, because one line, if it's basically spoken right and the body language is right and the character's good, that can have a big impact. I remember when I first saw the movie Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, a small role in that movie was Michael Shannon, who sort of played this kind of weird, bizarre brother of one of the characters, of the woman in the movie, of the female lead. And he was so good. I remember walking away from that movie going, oh, my God, who is that guy who is playing the brother? He's going to be big. And that was Michael Shannon. And basically a year later or 2 years later, he was huge.
Well, you know what? I had the same experience with Philip Seymour Hoffman, because in Sentinel Woman, he has that smaller role. It's like, who is that? He's going to be big. Yeah. He's good.
I agree.
Yeah.
I felt the same way the first time I saw The New Kids as well. In Australia, it was called Striking Back. James Spader plays a character in it called Eddie Dutra. And, oh, my God, he's just so good in that movie. But after that, anything Spader did, because I remember, you know, he really came to notice eventually when he did Sex, Lies, and Videotape. But before that, he did Tough Turf, and he did this film, The New Kids. He's so good in The New Kids that you just watch that and go, that's it, that guy. He could be the lead in any movie. And that was James Spader. That's one of James Spader's earliest roles, but it's such a strong role that, yeah, that's why you never, ever cast someone just because they're available. And, you know, I understand people going, well, you know, have family members. Okay, if you've got family members and friends, they can be extras. They can be people sitting in a restaurant in the back. But don't get anyone to say a line of dialogue that matters, that's going to be heard, unless they can do it really well, unless they can do it convincingly, and unless they can make it sound like it's the first time they've ever said it. You know, that's so key. And I think, in a sense, that was my biggest lesson from the first making a movie. When admittedly, my first film, I was probably more obsessed with the technology, you know, getting the camera in good positions and staging the fight scenes. I mean, you know, we had all kinds of stuff we had to deal with. We had accidents in that. We had a car get written off. We had a guy get hit by a car as well. It wasn't supposed to be hit by a car. It's in the movie. But back in those days, I was obsessed with the technical. Now I'm much more obsessed with the story and much more obsessed with the characters, you know, because that's what the audience basically, when someone goes, I love that movie, it's usually because they love the characters, and the characters are expressed through the actors.
Exactly. Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. This has been an absolute pleasure, to be honest. You know, Corey wasn't able to make it. I didn't need Corey. You just were a wealth of information, man. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Carl. It's been a pleasure to be on the show, and you know, I really appreciate the invite.
Okay, so before you go, please let's mention some of the films and where they can watch them again. Amazon Prime, people, Tubi, watch his movies.
Yeah, Amazon Prime, Purgatory Road, and Dress to Kill, and soon Hitman's Hero will be out there on that as well. And also Tubi TV has Purgatory Road and Dress to Kill as well. So, and also they are on Blu-ray as well, both Dress to Kill and on Purgatory Road Blu-ray. It's got two commentaries, one with me and the actor Gary Cairns, and also with the co-writer and executive producer Tom Parnell. So it's a bit of a filmmaking lesson on Purgatory Road. And then the new film Painkiller, which is about the opioid epidemic. It's Bill Oberst basically fighting against Big Pharma. That's the subject matter of the next movie. And that's going to be on basically platforms everywhere, but not for 6 to 9 months. So it's quite a long lead up, because we're doing a massive publicity, even related to opioid deaths and the whole opioid industry. That's going to very much be mixed in with the publicity for this movie, which basically really attacks and basically crucifies the Big Pharma.
Well, you know, I really applaud you for that, for using your film as making a point about pharma and issues, social issues and such like that. You know, that to do it in exploitation film. I always find that better than these, you know, really, really dry films that you get on subjects like that. So very good. You got to look for Painkiller. Yeah, it's very true. I mean, go ahead.
It's interesting you say that because that was the challenge, because we didn't want to make a film that was going to be like preaching to people about, you know, pharma is bad, opioids are bad, you know, and just being very, very literal about it. So, you know, it was like, let's come up with a story, because it was inspired by, like, my co-writer's son. He died at age 21 of basically inappropriately prescribed opioids. And so it was motivated by a real event. So his death motivated us to tackle this subject. But the challenge was, let's do it as an exploitation film. So essentially, it's still entertainment, but it's entertainment where you've actually got a stronger kind of point of view about Big Pharma, but at the same time still, you know, giving people what they expect from exploitation films, which is action and drama and, you know, violence and extremism, where you're still doing that. I mean, that was like key, because I wasn't interested in just making something that was just very, almost more like a dramatic documentary.
Right. Well, you know what? We just did a podcast on Sunday, this past Sunday, on social commentary on film, on Danae's Dungeon, and that's one of our podcasters on the system.
Oh, interesting.
But yeah, you know, that's a wonderful thing. And of course, I grew up in Pittsburgh, so, you know, George Romero is a god. And when you talk about, you know, horror movies and social commentary, there's nobody better, period.
I agree. I think I remember when I was quite young, hearing interviews, you know, about Dawn of the Dead, you know, when he talked about the whole aspect of consumerism. And yeah, and it just kind of really clarified for me, like, God, there's a guy making just killer horror movies, and he's able to get social commentary in there, but the social commentary never bogs down the drama. It's just really expertly threaded in there. And I agree, like, he's an expert at that. And he's one of my biggest influences. And Martin, his film Martin, to me, is also another absolute masterpiece.
Well, I'm good friends, and I've had John Amplis on the show.
Oh, wow.
We've talked about Martin. And I also had a very good friend of mine that unfortunately passed away many years ago, who was in Day of the Dead. Ralph Marrero played Rickles in that film.
Right.
And he and I knew each other in New York in the 80s. And
fascinating.
You know, so yeah, I mean, I've been obsessed with films ever since I was a kid. So, you know, I mean, it's a wonderful thing, and it is a drug. There is no doubt about it. It's a wonderful drug.
I'm the same.
It really is.
We're peas in a pod, you know. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I'm a film fan first, you know. Like, yeah, like I got hooked in at a very young age, you know. And yeah, there's no ever kind of coming down from it. But I think in a way, love of film and love of this, I think it kind of keeps us sane, you know. I really do. I think it's a really healthy outlet, and I think it's kind of keeps you sane. And horror, I think, is one of the most honest genres. And so that's why it's really great seeing interesting subjects being explored in horror, while at the same time still scaring, you know, repulsing and sort of unnerving people. You know, you can do so many things with that genre.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Well, again, Mark, thank you so much. This has been an absolute blast. You know, when you've got Painkiller and Pond Scum out there, please get in contact. We'll get you back on again anytime. You're welcome. Seriously.
I'd love that. That'd be great, Carl. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Okay, fair enough. Well, listen, you take care of yourself. I'm going to finish up here and let people know what's coming up here. So, again, thanks a lot, Mark. Really appreciate it.
Okay. All right. Ciao.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, folks. So this is what we're going to do. On Thursday in the morning, we are having a special podcast. It'll be at 11 o'clock on Thursday, and we're going to be talking to Keith Lansdale. Keith is the co-author the new film coming out. It is The Open Door. Keith is also the son of author Joe Lansdale, who gave us Bubba Hotep and Happy Leonard and many other film adaptations, Cold in July. So please join us for that. On Friday, we're going to have our first ever First Filmmakers podcast with a member of ISF. And they did their first film, and we're going to be talking to them. On Sunday, I know that we're going to have, Danae will have a show on Sunday in the dungeon, and that'll be at 8 o'clock. And then a week from today, we're going to take a week off from the ISF podcast because we've had basically two separate podcasts this week. And we're going to introduce a new show. And that would be A Twist of Horror with Limes. Or no, actually, take that back. Horror with a Twist of Limes. And that will be with Limes Marshall. And Limes and his co-host Amy and me will be talking about John Carpenter and his filmography. And perhaps we'll also get a special guest on there, maybe Troy Howarth or someone else, because Troy just did a book that's coming out from WK Press on Carpenter. So that's what we have coming up. I want to thank everybody for listening. And forgive the frog in my throat, but that's the way it goes. And we will talk to you next week. All right. And thank you very much for listening. All right. Good night, people.